Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It began with Evelyn Hamilton. A lonely 41-year-old pharmacist found strangled in an air raid shelter in Montague Place. With her legs spread, her genitals and right breast exposed, there was no doubt that she had been posed. Whether to shame her, to shock her finders, or to titillate her crazed torturer. It seemed like a one-off. But it was not. The next night, 34-year-old Evelyn Oatley, a sex worker known as Lita Ward, was found strangled with a stocking in her Wardour Street flat. Posed to elicit maximum horror, with great relish, he had carved up her semi-conscious body with a kitchen knife, a razor blade, and a can opener with a claw-like hook. Having thrust her metal torch deep into her gaping vagina. Two different police divisions handled each murder. But before they knew that the cases were connected, he had attacked again. This time, 43-year-old Margaret Florence Lowe, a widowed fancy dress shop owner, now sex worker, in a Gosfield Street flat. She had been posed, strangled, mutilated. And as with the others, he had stolen handbags, trinkets, and several unusual souvenirs, but rarely anything of any value. And while the police were mulling over what sort of homicidal maniac stalked their streets, the next night, he struck again. 32-year-old Doris June, a secret sex worker known as Olga, was slaughtered in her Sussex Gardens flat. In a scene so unsettling that it made the police photographer physically sick. Four women. All strangers. All different. All butchered over four consecutive nights in unconnected parts of the West End. But it had left the police with an unanswered question. Was this just a four-day killing spree? Or had the Blackout Ripper murdered before? My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. This is Murder Mile. And I present to you the conclusion to Murder Mile's original eight-part series. This is part one of two of the Blackout Ripper, First Blood. On Monday, the 27th of April, 1942, 28-year-old Gordon Frederick Cummings, a leading aircraftman of almost 7 years' service in the Royal Air Force, was tried before Mr. Justice Asquith and a jury of 12 men, in Court 2 of the Old Bailey. Issued with a court-appointed lawyer, paid for by legal aid, as was his prerogative, he gave no evidence in his defence, he professed his innocence throughout, and he pleaded not guilty to the charge of murder. In a trial, which only lasted a day, as the case had to be retried when the prosecution put forward the wrong fingerprints, the jury took just 35 minutes to find him guilty. With the judge stating,
"This court unhesitatingly takes the view that the evidence can only be described as overwhelming."
Evidence which Marjorie, his loyal wife of 3 years, had to sit and listen to in court, with his child growing in her belly. With both the Met Police branding the Blackout Ripper as a madman, and Home Office pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury decrying these attacks as the work of a sexual sadist, pleading insanity could have spared him a death sentence. But no plea of mental illness was given at his trial. Gordon Frederick Cummings was executed by hanging at Wandsworth Prison on the 25th of June 1942 at 9 a.m. There was no denying that he had murdered 4 women and attacked 2 more across 4 days in February 1942. But what seemed unbelievable was that a spree killer would appear out of nowhere, almost fully formed. He knew how to stalk his prey without panic, how to attack unheard, how to flee undetected. And he had explored all of the sick and twisted things that he would do to their trembling bodies. But a person doesn't just wake up and decide to become a killer. So where did he begin? The police would later state that Cummings was a viable suspect in 2 unsolved murders of 2 unrelated women, both on the fringes of Regent's Park, just 4 months before his West End attacks. The first was 19-year-old Mabel Church, who was murdered on Sunday the 12th of October 1941 at about 10 p.m. in an abandoned house at 225 Hampstead Road in Camden. She had been strangled and posed. The second was 49-year-old Edith Eleanor Humphreys, who had been beaten, strangled and stabbed in her home at 1 Gloucester Crescent, just 5 days and half a mile from Mabel. Mabel Church, often frustratingly confused owing to a dash of lazy journalism with a girl called Mabel Churchyard, was born on the 18th of June 1922. She was raised in West Ham and Stepney, East London, and later moved into a small lodging with her widowed mother in Tufnell Park, North London. From the age of 12, Vera Wymark was her best friend, and the two remained inseparable for the rest of her short life. Being a petite 5'1" tall and a dainty 8 stone, she was described as slim but sturdy. Blessed with a really cheeky smile, splashed with red lippy, which beamed bright from a pale oval face, Mabel was chatty, confident and approachable. And as a lifelong Londoner whose Aunt Bee lived in Camden, she was street smart and savvy. Mabel was popular with the boys, dating a railway worker called Don, who was on national service at the time of her death. And although some sources state that she engaged in casual sex with servicemen, this was unproven. And besides, it's easy to cast aspersions over the dead, who cannot defend themselves. By the outbreak of the Second World War, Mabel was working as an assistant in the electric department of Headway Board Council in West Ham, and 2 years later as a clerk at the Hackney Corporation. To do her bit for the war effort, she volunteered as a canteen assistant at the YMCA, preparing and serving meals in a series of hostels and mobile kitchens for factory workers and military servicemen. At the cusp of war, Vera's parents wisely moved their family from the constant barrage of bombs in West Ham to the leafy, less deadly suburb of West Wycombe in Kent. But that didn't stop Vera and Mabel being best friends. Vera later said, Mabel and I were at school together and often met in London to have tea and outings. Saturday the 11th of October 1941 was no exception, as nothing, even the bell-trembling drone of Nazi bombers in the clouds, the shrill of falling doodlebugs, and the cataclysmic bang as brick buildings were blasted into bits, would split these two pals apart. 2 years into the war, the threat seemed less threatening. So people went about their everyday lives, shopping, dining, working, and having fun. Death was a daily risk, but everyone did so with a sense of safety. They knew the route to their nearest shelter. During blackouts, they carried a torch. And in case of a chemical attack, they carried a gas mask. That day, Mabel met Vera at Charing Cross Station. Having finished her shift at the YMCA, she was still wearing her short black coat, black skirt, black shoes, and white blouse, with no stockings or hat. Her hair was swept up into two dark brown rolls, and in her handbag was her canteen cap and tabard. That night, they had dinner at one of the Lion's Corner House tea rooms. They frequented the theatre, possibly to see fun and games at the Prince's or Lady Behave at His Majesty's. By 10:30 p.m, they hopped a train to West Wycombe, and the two chums spent the night at Vera's parents' house as planned. On Sunday the 12th of October 1941, the girls returned to the West End for a spot of dinner and a trip to the Flicks, possibly to watch High Sierra with Humphrey Bogart or Billy the Kid with Robert Taylor. At 9 p.m, they parted ways at Charing Cross Station, having made plans to meet up sometime soon. But it was not to be. Vera would state, When I left her on Sunday night, I went to get my train, and she, I understand, was going to get a bus home. The Northern Line normally ran a tube train direct to her home in Tufnell Park. But owing to the bombings, the line was down. It could be a coincidence, but a few streets east, at Frith and Shepherd's Theatrical Supplies, Marjorie, the wife of Gordon Frederick Cummings, the Blackout Ripper, worked as a theatre agent's assistant. Here he often visited his wife, and his connecting station to her home in Barnes was Charing Cross. At 9:30 p.m, she was supposedly seen by an unnamed witness in an undisclosed pub, having a snack by herself. She was a 10-minute walk from where her body was found. At roughly 9:50 p.m., she departed an unnamed pub, cafe, or YMCA bar in either Euston, St. Pancras, or Camden. Clutching her handbag and torch, she walked a familiar route along the unlit streets to Hampstead Road and waited beside a row of derelict terraces which were part way through being demolished. Unfortunately, there were no known witnesses who saw her near or outside of 225 Hampstead Road. And again, it could be just a coincidence, but during his 4-day killing spree, Cummings was stationed at the No. 3 Aircrew Receiving Centre and was billeted at St. James's Close on the Prince Albert Road, all of which are on the perimeter of Regent's Park, just a 10-minute walk from where Mabel was murdered. But if this was one of the first kills by the Blackout Ripper, why did he choose Mabel? Unlike many serial killers or spree killers, Gordon Frederick Cummings didn't have a type. He wasn't driven wild by ladies who resembled long-lost lovers, or sought to inflict wounds on women who looked like those who had spurned his sexual advances. On the 9th of February 1942, at 11 p.m, just hours before he murdered Evelyn Oatley, while struggling to achieve an erection, he stroked the hair of sex worker Laura Denmark and said, I like blondes. That's why I picked you. But that clearly isn't true. If all six of these women were killed by Gordon Cummings, they ranged in heights from 5'1" to 5'10", in ages from 19 to 49, with hair colours from bright blonde to dark brunettes, every body shape from skinny to chubby, every job type from prostitutes to pharmacists, and they were all a mix of single, married or widowed. In fact, the only detail which unites all of them is that when he met them, they were alone. Being an opportunist, he attacked whenever or wherever he felt the urge. With Evelyn Oatley, Doris June, Margaret Lowe, Catherine Mulcahy, and possibly Edith Humphreys, having been welcomed into their homes, he used the privacy of their walls to shield his sadistic tortures from the wider world. That said, Greta Haywood was attacked in a busy alley off Piccadilly Circus. Evelyn Hamilton in a public air raid shelter near Marble Arch, and possibly Mabel Church in an abandoned house in Camden. We know he didn't fear being caught, as when his strangulation of Catherine Mulcahy was disturbed by a neighbour, he simply smiled, he calmly put back on his clothes, he lit up a cigarette, and he walked away. As for whether he met and possibly charmed Mabel before luring her to her death, it's possible, as he didn't have a regular haunt and was happy to travel. Drinking at the Volunteer, Universal Brasserie, Café Monaco, Salted Almond, Chandos, Odenio's, Prince's, the Negro Bar and the Red Lion, all the way from St. John's Wood to Hammersmith, and he ate anywhere from cafes and pubs to chains like the Lion's Corner House tea rooms and several YMCA canteens. In each case, they may have been lulled into a false sense of security, as never once did he try to hide his identity. He always used his real name. He never disguised his face. He wore his RAF uniform, emblazoned with his rank and unit, and he openly talked with each woman about his career, his wife, and his life. Each victim was strangled, but he didn't carry a rope or garrote to inflict this. Instead, he used either his left hand or their own stockings or knickers. Sometimes, the strangulation was preceded by several hard blows to the face or head. And as with the savage mutilation of their bodies, he used whatever object he could find. Details of which had striking similarities to Mabel Church and Edith Eleanor Humphreys. Two women, as different as any other victim, and whose bodies were discovered half a mile and 5 days apart. Almost as if a fledgling serial killer was finding his feet. The murder of Mabel Church was seen by no one, but it may have been heard. At 10 p.m. on Sunday the 12th of October 1941, from her flat overlooking the blackened shell of 225 Hampstead Road, Miss Lucy Wirtz later stated, It sounded like someone was being attacked. I thought the scream came from boys and girls playing in the road. And then I heard a second scream. Being unwilling to put themselves in danger, the neighbours dismissed these terrified screams as mere tomfoolery. Ten hours later, Mr. C.H. Smith of Dalston arrived, being part of a team of contractors hired to complete the manual demolition of this bombed-out row of houses. Being little more than a brick block, it had no windows, no doors, few floors, and the partition walls were nothing but rubble. Even the wrought iron railings had been recycled into much-needed munitions for the war. So as he ascended the small set of steps out front, he didn't expect to see anyone else inside, except for builders, pigeons, and rats. Only Mr. Smith was not alone. He later said, I walked into the house and I saw through a broken wall a pair of bare feet. With Mabel's shoes found in the basement, it was uncertain if they had fallen through the floorboards or if she had died down below and her body was later carried up and carefully placed on the boards of the ground floor. Either way, those who found her were all in agreement that she looked as if she had been posed. Shocked by the sight of a young dead girl, with her thin pale arms free of any defensive wounds, and her jaw swollen with a thick black bruise, it was clear that her assailant had knocked her unconscious with a quickness, so he could do all of the despicable things he dreamed of to her body. With a great violence, he had ripped off her clothes, her skirt, her blouse, and her bra, leaving just her short black coat splashed across her bare shoulders, like he had made a faint gesture of modesty. Only she died without an ounce of compassion from her killer, as he watched her short life slip away. Tearing them into a long strip, he tied her ripped camisole knickers around her neck, and pinning her slim frame to the floor, with her arms trapped by her side, he pulled both ends tight so tight that the cotton cut so deep into her flesh that even if she wasn't knocked out, no one could undo the knot. With a swollen tongue protruding from her gaping lips, her angelic skin now mottled with little purple eruptions, and her eyes all black like two wet lumps of coal. Whereas once she had a sweet and cheeky face, this was now gone, replaced by a glimpse of unimaginable horror, as if she had died mid-scream. The investigation was headed up by Detective Superintendent Yandel and Detective Inspector Clare, who just 4 months later was the lead investigator of the Blackout Ripper murders. But at this point, they were not aware of Gordon Frederick Cummings, and Mabel's death didn't match any other. As part of protocol, the pathologist Sir Bernard Spilsbury examined the body. He established her death as strangulation by ligature, and an inquest was opened by Ingleby Oddy at St Pancras Coroner's Court. With no eyewitnesses nor viable suspects, the police questioned every known offender and army deserter in their files, but every clue only led to another brick wall. They published her photo in the local newspapers, hoping to jog people's memories, but no one remembered or admitted to seeing her. Chief Inspector Frederick Cheryl of Scotland Yard was unable to detect any fingerprints on site. But at the autopsy, he did find several skin-deep imprints where her killer had touched her naked flesh with his bare hands. With this revolutionary technique still in its infancy, he sent the prints off to the police laboratory at Hendon. But being of a very delicate nature, they proved unusable for the detectives. And with that, the investigation into the murder of Mabel Church came to an unfortunate close. They had no witnesses, no fingerprints, very little evidence, and more importantly, no viable suspects. But was this the work of the Blackout Ripper? There are many striking similarities between each attack. Each victim, regardless of whether they lived or died, was strangled, either manually by a left-handed man or using the victim's underwear. Rarely did his victim struggle, as his initial attack was swift. This was achieved by pinning their arms to their sides, their bodies to the bed or the floor, and rendering them unconscious with a single punch to the head or face. On occasions, their clothes may have appeared scraped and their shoes scuffed, but this was often as they were dragged into position to be posed, or during the death throes of their strangulation. Each victim was stripped naked or semi-clad, and each time, he deliberately moved the body, even if the position was awkward, so that their exposed vaginas faced the only door. The post-mortem confirmed that Mabel had not been sexually assaulted, a common trait among his victims, as with Cummins cursed by a high sex drive and erectile dysfunction, often he would attempt rape or sex, but there would be no evidence of vaginal or anal entry, and no semen in any orifice. Which is not to say that he couldn't, or that he didn't try. But maybe, committing such abhorrent acts in a public place, maybe he was disturbed by a passerby and was forced to flee for fear of being seen. This may also explain why, unlike some later victims, Mabel Church and Evelyn Hamilton were not mutilated. Maybe he was seen. Maybe he hadn't a weapon to hand. Or maybe, being new to killing and unsure of what he disliked or desired, he was yet to truly develop his cruel and sadistic streak. The 4-day killing spree of the Blackout Ripper came out of nowhere. Even during these horrific attacks, no one suspected him of anything so heinous. So maybe it was during the October of 1941 that he honed his dastardly skills, found what fueled his fire, and this helped him to gain the confidence as a serial killer. Being inexperienced in the ways of murder, maybe Mabel's death was his first faltering attempt. With the strangulation, the assault, the savagery and the posing of the body, all guided by a sadistic instinct. From this point on, they became part of his tried and tested technique. The Blackout Ripper's attacks lacked premeditation. As in the same night, some women he would kill and torture, whereas others he would treat with kindness and respect. So maybe, believing Mabel's death was a fluke, 5 days later, Edith's death would become his validation that he was a man who could kill with impunity and never be caught. If these were the work of the Blackout Ripper, he made his usual mistakes by leaving fingerprints. But still being a little cautious, he wasn't so arrogant as to misplace his gas mask or belt, which would later convict him. It was said that Gordon Frederick Cummings was considered a viable suspect by the police in both cases. But with very little conclusive evidence, no charges could posthumously be brought against him. Were the murders of Mabel Church and Edith Humphreys really the work of the Blackout Ripper? Or are we just desperately scrabbling for answers in the dark? The truth may be in his past. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. The concluding part of the Blackout Ripper First Blood concludes on Thursday. Or for some Patreon subscribers, on Monday, 3 days earlier. Ooh! And if you'd like to refresh your mind, why not listen to the original 8-part series called The Blackout Ripper by Murder Mile? As always, for those who wonder where the origin of the song Who Ate All the Pies came from, and for those who want to know more about this case, as well as enjoying a cake and a quiz, stay tuned till after the break for Extra Mile. A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Barry Porter and Ken McRitchie. I thank you both. Your goodies should be with you by now, unless the postman has kicked them under the bins again. With a thank you to Selena Dean and Lucy Barr for your very kind donations via the Murder Mile eShop. If Eva hasn't already spent it on vodka and Alka-Seltzer, I plan to spend it on a coot-shaped cake. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh dear God. Hey everyone, how you all doing? Oh, right, well, I'm yawning, but I'm yawning in a different way. Because normally I'm yawning because I'm grumbling that it's too early in the morning and I'm tired. And oh, look, it's not even dawn yet. And oh, Coot's been noisy. But Coot is fast asleep. He's fast asleep because this is evening. This is evening tired. This is almost 7 o'clock at night. I was going to do the recording tomorrow morning, but I've already gone on a walk down to the channelery down the road. I had a look at the boats down there, and I want to move my boat tomorrow, and there's a couple of spaces, and because it's nighttime, people tend not to move their boats, so I'm thinking I'm going to move tomorrow morning, so I need to get up early. So I thought to myself, bollocks, I will record Murder Mile now, because I'd already got the script ready. Oh, but my throat's sore, hence, and I, oh, I think I had more energy in the mornings. I can pep myself up and I've had my coffee, but I felt really tired on that one. So I hope that recording goes well. I might have to do an evening record for the second part, otherwise it'll sound bollocksy. Right, let's go on. I'm going to put on a cup of tea. I normally wouldn't have a cup of tea this late in the doodah, the what's it, the thingamajig, but I think I need one. I'm all over the shop. It hasn't helped that I've done 24,000 steps today. There we go. It's just my safety certificate on the boat done today, which I can't concentrate when people are on the boat or when I know people are going to be on the boat. If I know I've got a day to myself, I'm all right. I can sit here, I can write, I can edit, I can do what I need to do. If I know someone's going to turn up, even if it's in the evening, it throws me off. And I can't settle. I can't. Yeah, weird. I'm all right when I'm in coffee shops because I don't write or edit in coffee shops. I get all the shite done, all the extraneous shite that you don't need to do. But I don't get any of the important stuff like writing or editing done in a coffee shop. Not that we can go back to coffee shops anymore. We've just had the announcement that we just hit 49,000 cases in a day. With COVID, lockdown's coming. Oh, exciting. Yeah, another Christmassy lockdown. Anyway, as long as the government have their nice Christmas parties, we've all enjoyed looking at that, haven't we? Anyway, let's distract ourselves from that bullshit. Cake of the week, I'm not too sure. Do you know what? I did my usual thing. I went up to the cake shop and I went, oh, I'll have a bread pudding, which I've eaten. And I've had an apple and almond sponge thing. It was really nice. I had to eat it quick because it's one of those gooey things and you leave it in the bag and it just goes to shit. So I've had those and I've got two those lattice things that are very nice that have the pecan nuts in them. They're really nice. I've got two of those and they've got icing on them, and I've got something else as well, and I've got some sausages and I've got some chicken and I might do a ramen in a bit. Oh, I'm really hungry. What else is going on? We had the last Murder Mile walk last weekend, so that is my tour of Soho. All went well. Thank you to everyone who has attended Murder Mile over the last
Christ, 7 years. Wasn't meant to be 7 years. I wasn't even meant to do one tour. Ended up being 7. Thank you to everyone who's turned up over the years. You've been wonderful. Thank you so much. Plan is to have the new tour up and running in spring, summer. I don't know when. I don't have a date for it. You can't buy tickets for it yet. I don't want to think about it just yet. I just want to give myself a break. So that's all good. If you have a voucher that you haven't used up for Murder Mile, that's fine. That's why I kept the tours open for the last 6 months, so you could use up your vouchers. I understand if people can't. If you want to email me and I can exchange that donation, turn it into that ticket and exchange it for a donation for St Mungo's, which is a homeless charity that looks after all the homeless people in West End, mostly, well, London. I'm happy to let you use those tickets for the new tour when they come up. So ignore the expiry date and then we'll shift into that. God, that was waffle, wasn't it? Just powering through stuff at the moment. This is a two-parter. I'm editing this now. I'll probably get this edited and then start work on the next episode. And then we're done. I've got one little secret thing that I'll do as well. But then we're done for Christmas. So I'm hoping that I'll be done by the 23rd. And then I can take some time off. I'd love to go and see my dad and my stepmom. Unfortunately, I can't. Because COVID is going all shitty and my dad's immune system is shit. He was in hospital for the last 5 days. His kidneys just went poof, whoop, touch and go for a bit. But he was in a pretty bad way. But he's made a recovery now, so he's resting up. He looks really, really painfully thin at the moment. But that's why I would love to go up and see him. But I don't want to risk going up there, even though I've had all my jabs and I had my booster during the week and that was great. And my arm has been hurting like I've been wanking for about 50 days. How would I know that? Just a guess. I'm guessing. The podcast finishes at the end of the year. I think the last episode is the 30th of December. As always, I take a little bit of a break when I do. I give myself a little bit of a break because I bloody need it. And then I do the final part of the research. And then we restart. I think it's 23rd or 24th of February. That's the new season. That's when we all restart. But on Patreon. Patreon. He's waffling on about it again. If on certain tiers, I think it's there's a $7 tier or above, you get Walk With Me, which is the weekly podcast. And if you enjoy this chatty bit, this is me taking a walk. I go through woods. I visit some doggers. I risk getting run over a lot. But what I do on those is I fill you in on all the details that I don't tell you an extra mile about the cases. But in January and February, what I always do is I fill you in on all the research, so you learn about all the cases coming up, and I take you on little walks with doggers. But in January and February, I make sure that everyone has access to this, all the patrons. So it doesn't matter what tier you're on, January, February, you get access to all these. You get access to Walk With Me, and people seem to enjoy it. So, it's just me doing what I need to do. Sometimes I do my washing. Sometimes I'm having a snooze. You know, it's all good fun. This kettle's taking a long time. Or maybe it's just because I've run out of shite to say. I'm going to dive into some questions in a bit, and then we'll dive into some stuff about this case as well. I need to be really careful because obviously we're going to dive into part two next week, of which we'll dive back into the Blackout Ripper's back history. And we will dive into more about Edith Eleanor Humphreys, which is the other murder that they say that the Blackout Ripper committed. I think that's done. I'm going to grab that. That should be done. Or maybe I should just grab me a beer. That would be lovely. Oh, that's why. I think I put too much water in. Oh, it's hot. Hot. Here we go. Powdered milk in. It is winter. I can buy regular milk. It's just I just can't be arsed. The only time I buy regular milk is when I'm making Angel Delight. Ooh, yes. Angel Delight. That's my little treat. Switch light off. Right, coming back. Holidays are coming. Holidays are coming. What's that in there? Something is in my tea. What the frick is that? Right, something's in my tea. It looks disgusting. I'm guessing it could be... Da, 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 da. Oh, I don't know. It just looks shit. I thought it was an insect because I had one of those big mosquito shit things flying around. And I thought it was that. But when I picked it up out of my teeth, something broke into two. It can't be that. Anyway, let's do the quiz questions, then we'll dive in. Right. Don't forget, I'll probably balls up some of these questions. So that's it. Just accept it. If I balls it up, you get a free question. Right. What was the name? Question number one. What was the name of the doctor who certified Mabel as dead? So what was the name of the doctor who certified Mabel as dead? Question number two. Who does Mabel often get confused with by lazy authors and journalists who can't be asked to do their job properly? Yes. Question number three. What films is it possible that Vera and Mabel saw at the cinema? There was two that I mentioned there. Question four. What was the name of Mabel's boyfriend and what did he do as a job? Question five. I got burpees. What was the name of the lady who possibly heard Mabel being murdered? Question number six. Who was the judge at Gordon Cummings' trial? Question seven. What was the first name of Gordon's wife? Question eight. What did his wife do as a job? Question nine. Name either of the plays that Vera and Mabel may have watched that night. Yeah. And question 10. Roughly how many minutes walk away is the murder scene of Mabel to Edith's? So let's dive into some extra stuff. Obviously, around the time of World War II, there's kind of a lot of murders that we seem to be picking up on in and around the West End, many of them to do with military personnel. It's understandable, really. You've got a high influx of people coming into town, using sex workers, getting drunk, using drugs, you know. Obviously, there's a lot of PTSD going on as well, but that kind of wasn't really acknowledged in that era. Episodes that we can go back to was Ralph Bradley McKinstry. If you go back to that, that was the Peggy Richards episode where he got that lady and he threw her off Waterloo Bridge. We've got the James Forbes McCallum one, which was the guy who tried to rob the Coach and Horses pub in Covent Garden. There's that one you can go back to. There's loads, actually, of servicemen. There's the unfortunate Mr. Johnson is also on there as well. I just realised that I should really do my hair and have a shave tomorrow. That'll be on my list. There were 305 wartime murderers who have been set free. Hang on, I think I've got my data wrong there. Here we go. 818 known murders in England and Wales from 1940 to 1944. These were known murders. Obviously, the problem is, especially during wartime, there was a lot of bodies found, but it was hard to determine whether... Sometimes the police would turn up and they'd go... It was hard to determine whether it was a murder or whether... they'd been killed in bombings or things like that. Often they often found that people would dump bodies in old bomb sites and you couldn't really tell the difference. Obviously, don't forget, you haven't really got a fully functional police force around this time. So of those 818 known murders in England and Wales during that era, 219 cases, the suspect committed suicide. 51 of them were acquitted when they were tried. One of them had their conviction quashed and six had their charge lowered to murder. Many of these cases that were not solved, there was quite a few of them at the time. Obviously, we got Mabel Church, we got Edith Humphreys there. There's Helen Hoyes, who's a 55-year-old kitchen assistant at the American Red Cross in Southampton. That's too far out of my remit, so I won't be going there. And Mrs. Eileen Cook, known as Irish Molly, who was seen with a soldier on the 5th of February 1945. This is over in Bethnal Green, so I won't be covering that one, but there's a lot more that will be cropping up. Jean Stafford over in Bedford Place, I'll be covering that one, and Theodora Green as well. Waiting till I can get the archive files for that one. So, Mabel Church, as mentioned, murdered 12th of October 1941 around 10 p.m. roughly. She was found roughly around 8 a.m. the next morning. Unfortunately, with this file, with both these murder cases, the files are not available. One of them is available in 3 years' time, but I suspect that that would be pushed back, as always happens, because it's so fresh and there's probably still relatives who are alive. That will probably go to court soon. They'll have a look at it and they'll take out some details. The other one, I think it's Edith's one, that is not available for another 20 years, so... hopefully I'll still be alive by that point. You never know. Eva may work me to death. Or shag me to death, hopefully. Did you hear that? Everyone seemed to like Mabel. She seemed like a really nice lady. She was quite sweet. She was quite confident. She was quite street savvy. As mentioned, she worked as a kitchen assistant. Hence, in her bag, she had her kitchen tabard and her cap. She also had some spare clothes in her bag, and she was planning to go down to her there's that little mosquito, little bastard. I think that's his name, mosquito bastard. It's because the air's warm outside and there's a lot of mosquitoes and midges around, little bastards. Yeah, she had some spare clothes with her because she was planning to stay at Vera's that night. As we know, she worked at the electricity department for both the Hackney Corporation and Headway Board Council over in West Ham. But she worked in as the kitchen assistant in the service canteens for servicemen in the West End. She worked in different areas. So I know that she worked at the one at Waterloo Station, London Bridge, St Pancras Station, and there were a lot of mobile kitchens as well, little vans that were going around. And they supplied food for the people who were working in factories nearby, back of Oxford Street. It made like behind Selfridges and places like that. It looks like it's very nice now, but a lot of those were kind of munitions factories as well, which is why Oxford Street got bombed the shit out of it, because there's munitions factories everywhere. And she was making the meals, but also serving them in those different areas. Now, a lot of people confuse Mabel Church with the name that I can't mention because it's part of the quiz. Where this came about was because on one official document, unfortunately, the person who was typing the document up on the front page of the document used the wrong name. Now, we don't know why they did that. They were just obviously just a twat. But luckily, we have the evidence of Vera Wymack. And Vera was Mabel's best friend for like half of her life, since they were 12 years old, so you know, a big chunk of her life. So a lot of the details that we get about Mabel Church comes from her best friend Vera, and I'm more likely to believe Vera, who knew her and they were best friends and they were side by side forever, like sisters, than focusing on a document which probably had someone who wasn't paying attention. As we've seen many times in court documents, police documents, quite often things just happen. People just make mistakes. We're human. Whereas Vera, it's unlikely that she would get her best friend's surname wrong. As mentioned in here, there's a lot of kind of spurious sources who often say that Mabel Church was known to engage in casual sexual relations with servicemen. Right, I can't find anything that proves that. Maybe in the file, maybe that does prove it, but I can't find anything categorically that said that she was a sex worker. Or, do you know, this is the kind of thing that we see quite a lot, especially you see it with the kind of the Jack the Ripper case and things like that. There's a big chunk about this going to be in Murder Mile, the book. I think a lot of people have a tendency to go, well, if we say that she's a sex worker, therefore we don't have to, you know, we can, we don't have to care that much about the fact that she's dead. We can kind of pick apart all the details. We can go, oh, let's dive into all the horrible, murky stuff about the life. Oh, it's fine then, because she's a sex worker. Who fucking cares? Right? But I just think that's absolutely despicable. So there was nothing that states that she was a sex worker. Therefore, I've poo-pooed that. If anyone can disprove that, please do, but just don't use shitty tabloids, fuck's sake. Oh, the amount of mistakes. For Murder Mile, the book, I'm finding so much in the tabloids. They're just shite. And you just think, wow, you really aren't doing any research. You're just churning out shitty stories in the hope that morons will pick it up and go, yeah, oh, look at that, disgusting, yeah, yeah, yeah. Fuck's sake. Vera and her friends. Okay, so her parents lived in West Wickham, down in Kent. Well, it's Kent then, but the boundaries of where the counties were keep moving all the time. So it was only about 100 years ago that kind of Bermondsey was classified as Kent, really. I just pulled off my plaster that was covering over my where I had my booster done the other day, my wanky booster. So you can keep seeing it. So West Wickham is classified as Kent then, but really it's between Bromley and Addington, so it's not really that far away. But details here that I can't give you. We will just skip through that. Vera's comment, she said, Mabel and I were at school together in West Ham. We often used to meet in London for tea and outings. When I left her on Sunday night, I went to get the train to West Wickham. And she, I understand, was getting her bus home. The line going over the Thames was bombed about 6 months earlier. So the line was still down. So she could theoretically have just got on the Northern Line and headed straight up to Tufnell Park, but it was down, so therefore she had to get a bus from the Strand up to, unfortunately there was two, so either to King's Cross or to Euston, and it's more likely that it was the Euston one, because that's the side that you get off at on that bus timetable to get to the Hampstead Road. So it was there. I did that. I went through all the old bus timetables to check that out. Where she ended up, we don't know. This is where it gets weird. If she would have got on her bus at about 9:10 from the Strand, she would have arrived around 9:30. So it's likely that she may have gone to a pub or a cafe or a YMCA bar. She knew the area well. She was seen in a pub that's not mentioned. It's not mentioned for any spurious, whole kind of horrible reasons. It's just kind of, it just wasn't mentioned. That people did. I've had to pull this together from lots of different sources, so therefore I can't find out exactly which one it was, but I will do when the original files come out. She was in a pub having a snack, inverted commas, by herself. She didn't appear to be with anyone. So whether the Blackout Ripper actually met her in that area, because he knew Charing Cross area well, he knew the Strand and Oldwich well, because that's where his wife is based, or that could just be coincidence. It really could be. So we don't know. What else we got? The 225 Hampstead Road was originally marked as the former home of Alfred Tennyson, the poet. But unfortunately, this building was bombed. There was a series of bombings that happened during World War II, and during World War I, during the Blitz, this area was really badly bombed out. So this building, unfortunately, was in the process of being demolished. And if you go there now, or if you go onto the Patreon site and you look at the videos, I've posted some pictures of what the building would have looked like. There's a nice picture of Sir Bernard Spilsby coming out of the murder location itself. But in its place now is a series of block of flats on the Hampstead Road. The lady, whose name I won't mention, see, I'm getting good at this, who said she heard the scream. She said it sounded like someone was being attacked. I thought the scream came from boys and girls playing in the road. Then I heard a second scream. She was strangled using her own camisole knickers. If it was the Blackout Ripper, her attacker had ripped them off, had put them into kind of a long thread, tied them around her neck and strangled her. He'd already beaten her, punched her across the face. Unfortunately, we don't know what in some cases, in later documents, I say documents, it's kind of articles where people have written about this, they've spuriously said that she was hit on her right-hand side, which means it's a left-handed punch. But there's no evidence anywhere of what side of the face the bruise on. And it's kind of easy to just say, well, she had a bruise on the right-hand side of her face, therefore he was left-handed. But, you know, I'm not willing to take that. I'm not willing to say that on there. I would rather, if I can find evidence of which side of her face she had the bruise on, that makes sense. But it doesn't necessarily mean that her attacker was left-handed. 12% of the population are left-handed. Although, even with the pathologists do state that the only way that you can tell whether if she was strangled, I mean, if she was punched by someone who's left-handed, likely it would be on the right-hand side of her face, but it depends whether she was facing him or whether she's turned away. Because if she was turned left and he punched her, it's still possible. Strangulation, you could kind of say that. A lot often they say you can tell the difference between whether how a left-handed person and right-handed person ties a knot behind the neck. Unfortunately, we don't have any information about which way it was tied. All we know is that it was tied really hard, and that the knot was deep into her neck. So we don't know exactly whether it was a left-handed knot or a right-handed knot. We also don't know whether Cummins, who was left-handed, could do right-handed knots. It's possible that he could. So we can make it, there's a lot of conjecture we can say about this, but we can't get everything. We can't get details right. So I'm only going to give you what I can confirm on this. We don't know whether anything was stolen from her bag. Her bag was there. Her waitress's cap was there. Her tabard. Some clothes. A number of letters. We don't know what these letters were. Possibly between her and Vera. Or maybe her boyfriend. Maybe her boyfriend who was overseas at the time. And her gas mask. As mentioned, her clothes had been ripped off, inverted commas, with great violence. And then her short jacket was put kind of either underneath her shoulders or over her shoulders. It's not clear on different sections. And everyone seemed to believe that she was posed. But obviously the shock of the body, you're seeing a body, you're seeing it there. Is it posed, or was the body put in a position so he could attempt to rape the corpse and then couldn't achieve it? As we know with the Black Heart Ripper, he has a lot of erectile problems, which is where his issues many times seem to come from. The doctor who turned up, whose name I won't mention, the divisional surgeon, he said that she'd been dead for at least 12 hours. He turned up at around 10 p.m, which makes sense. That would be 12 hours if you go back to when they heard the screams. Although he did state, because of the weather conditions, it was very cold at the time, so this could affect the timings. What else we got? As mentioned before, there's kind of no signs of a struggle, so obviously he'd punched her quick. We still don't know why she was in the building. This is something that's kind of, there's issues around this. So one, the police believe that she was waiting at a bus stop nearby, which makes sense because the bus stop was near, although I would dispute that, because if she was going north to Tufnell Park, she'd be on the opposite side of the road, whereas the houses were on the south side of the road, which doesn't make sense. So either she was dragged from the other side of the road into those abandoned buildings, which could happen, but it doesn't. That's the police's theory, that she was waiting at the bus stop, someone got her, dragged her into the building. That's why they heard the screams. The more salacious people out there who kind of have tried to investigate this, they suggest that she was a sex worker and therefore she went into an abandoned building to have sex with a young man for money. There's no evidence of that at all. And I think that's kind of cruel to cast the assumptions that she was a sex worker when we don't have any evidence of that. Prove me wrong. But as we know, she hadn't been sexually interfered with. So kind of disputes the idea that someone had kind of attacked her to rape her and then couldn't do anything. But then again, as we've seen, Blackout Ripper has erectile dysfunction. So What else we got? I try not to ruin too much for next week, because next week is going to be a big one. I think it was interesting that Chief Inspector Cheryl, who was also, he's kind of the leader from the Fingerprint Bureau. He's kind of the guy who kind of, a lot of the things that we do today based around fingerprints came from Chief Inspector Cheryl. He had found skin deep imprints on the body. So this is 1941. And even though he couldn't find usable fingerprints in the location itself, because don't forget, this is a derelict building. It's covered in dust. So, you know, you can't, your oils don't sit anywhere. That's what fingerprints are, is the oils on your skin, and the ridges is the bits where that don't have the oil in between. And that's what you see. But if you've got surfaces that are covered in dust, it you may be able to look at it and go, oh, fantastic. But it's hard to kind of pry those off and to get viable, kind of clear fingerprints. So he couldn't get any of that because it was a building site. But he was able to see them on the body. Obviously, her body had been covered in clothes, and then it had been removed. And if he'd got oils on his hands, he was able to see that. Or maybe the fingerprints were kind of a little bit sooty as well, a little bit dirty. So he tried to take them off. It was a new system they were developing over at Hendon. Unfortunately, they said they were... Oh, that was a burp. Sorry about that. They were of a really delicate nature, and unfortunately, they corroded. Even in advance, he'd already said to the detectives, look, this is a new technique. The prints have a tendency to become damaged. And unfortunately, because of that, no fingerprints exist. So do you know what? Hats off to him for trying. He saw that he couldn't find the fingerprints anywhere else. He had a look at the body, found some on there. He tried his best, couldn't make it. As mentioned, there's a lot of theories out there. I've mentioned already about her being a sex worker. Obviously, we got kind of no evidence for that at all. Let's not forget, not all of the victims of the Blackout Ripper were sex workers. Greta Hayward wasn't. Evelyn Hamilton wasn't. Next week, Edith Eleanor Humphreys. Again, the press and some unscrupulous people try to assume that she was a sex worker. And the reason why is because the police and the press had said at the time that Mabel Church had lots of men friends. She's popular with the boys. Therefore, a lot of the press and unscrupulous journalists and people like that have said sex worker. Same with Edith Humphreys for next week. She had a lot of men friends, but she was a widower. She was a 49-year-old widower. What's she going to do? She's going to sit there and just freaking grieve for the rest of her life? She wants to get out of there. She wants to find herself someone nice. Therefore, she had some men friends. Not all of them were sexual acquaintances. Some of them were just men friends. I don't understand why people don't understand that, and why they have to make this kind of spurious leap into being you can tell I'm getting cranky because I haven't eaten yet. Oh frick, and my knees are sore as well because I've been doing a lot of walking. Yeah. What else we got? Men friends have done that bit. Done that bit. Was this T-Ball? Was this Blackout Ripper? I don't know. What I'm going to do next week is we're going to dive into his past. When I was doing the Blackout Ripper series, the eight-parter, I dove deep into that, and I got a lot of details about him, and there was a lot in there that I didn't use in the original series because it just didn't seem to make sense. I haven't even had a slurp of tea yet. Cripes. Tea from my Murder Mile mug. There was a lot in there, and I learnt a lot about where he was posted, where he went, kind of pubs he went to, brothels he went to, kind of things like that. And I never got to use it, and I thought, I kept hold of it, and I thought, one day I can. And this is the point now. So what I'm going to do is we're going to do Edith Hamilton's, Edith Humphrey's murder. There's lots of Ediths and lots of surnames beginning with H, and I'm getting confused. And then what we'll do is we'll dive into his back history, because if Mabel Church is his first murder, and then you got Edith Humphreys is his second murder, if there must be something prior to that, there must be something pre that, because if the Soho murders, I'm calling them the Soho murders, but kind of the West End murders, the killing spree was kind of him on a big rampage, and these were his kind of pre murders. These were kind of him finding his feet. There has to be something prior to that. You don't just make a decision to become a murderer. So, yeah. Interesting case. I'm not going to dive into too much more because next week's episode, I've still got to write that. But I hope you enjoyed that episode. It's been on my mind to do this for ages, and I was trying to find. As always, I try and end the season with a big series, and I hadn't really got one lined up. I had, but another podcast has already done a kind of something similar to that, and I was like, oh, I don't want to. I need to find a new angle now. I can't. If someone else has already done an episode on it, it kind of ruins it for me, really. So hence I decided. I thought, right, I've got all my data. I will now do the Blackout Ripper First Blood. Right, let's do answers to the questions. Question number one, what was the name of the doctor who certified Mabel as dead? His name was Dr. Grief. Lovely. Question number two, who does Mabel often get confused with by lazy authors who can't be asked to do their job properly? Her name is Mabel Churchyard. You'll see it in books all the time. They'll go Mabel Church or Mabel Churchyard. No, not Mabel Churchyard. Mabel Church. That's her name. How do we know that? Because we've got all her background details and we've got a lot of details from Vera, her best friend. End of. Her name is Mabel Church. End. Unfortunately, in the National Archive files, this is one of the files that we can't get out, of which on the front someone has written Mabel Churchyard, but it's wrong. That's the problem. The amount of times I've pulled out an archive file, and even in court documents, even the judge quite often will say someone's name, and you go, but that's not their name. And you just go, God, what is going on in the world? Question number three. What films is it possible that Vera and Mabel saw at the cinema? Now, obviously, because I don't have access to the files, I don't know which films they saw, but ones that were available in the West End that night were High Sierra and Billy the Kid. I've written Billy the Kind there because I'm a twat. Also, coming up soon, but wasn't quite available, Citizen Kane had just come out, as was Dumbo. But unfortunately, being in Britain, we didn't get like American films for like another 6 months to a year, as always. Question number four, what was the name of Mabel's boyfriend and what did he do as a job? His name was Don and he was a railway worker. Police investigated him and he was serving overseas at the time because he was on national service. So he's not considered a suspect. There's almost no suspects in the murder of Mabel Church, which makes it baffling. You would find one or two, but there's pretty much none. Question five, what was the name of the lady who possibly heard Mabel being murdered? Her name was Miss Lucy Wirtz. Question number six, who was the judge at Gordon Frederick Cumming's trial? It was Mr. Justice Asquith. I struggle saying that during the recording. Question number seven. What was the first name of Gordon's wife? Her name was Marjorie. Question number eight. What did she do as a job? She was a theatre agent's assistant. Question number nine. Name either of the plays Mabel or Vera may have watched at the theatre. Obviously, of course, we don't know, but these were the ones that were available. They were Fun and Games at the Prince's Theatre or Lady Behave at His Majesty's. And question number 10, how many minutes walk away is the murder scene of Mabel's to Edith's? It's roughly 8 to 10 minutes walk. You can almost see them from each other. In fact, next to Edith's is a church, and from Mabel's you can see and hear the church. So it's amazing when you look at it. If you become a patron subscriber, I've done you a little map, and you can see on there I've put the murder locations for Edith and Edith and Mabel, but then I've also put all of the other murder locations for the other Blackout Ripper killings, but also the locations where the Blackout Ripper's billets were, where he was stationed, and the places he was known to pick up prostitutes as well. And it's fascinating when you look at it, you just go, Wow. There's he got around. I think I've overspoken. Yeah, I've said too much. So I'm going to shut up now. Michael, shut up. And also it's Din Din's time and my battery on my laptop is almost dead. So, that was another burpee. Thank you so much for listening to Murdermar. This episode concludes next week. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.